Good evening.
Good evening.
Wow, our new system really works. It's the first time I've actually used it, so hopefully you can hear me. And if you detect a little bit of an Australian accent there, you're right, I'm not from New Jersey. Someone mentioned that once. My name is Kim Sayed. I'm the president of the Historical Society of Pennsylvania. And as I was mentioning to our guest speaker, Dr. Pickens, this is much better weather than we had first expected. If you recall, this event had been scheduled for last February, and we were under snow like crazy. So now I think we have the other problem of people coming in outside of the beautiful weather after a really long winter. So it is my distinct pleasure to be introducing you to Dr. Pickens, but before I do that, I want to have two thanks. One actually is to Southwest Airlines, who have been tremendous supporters of the Historical Society for their sponsorship of tonight's event. If you fly anywhere, take Southwest is my suggestion, also because they give you snacks. It's true, you get these little bags of things, which is pretty unheard of these days. And also I want to thank the Urban League of Philadelphia, who are, again, a tremendous organization in Philadelphia, who have been great partners on tonight. So tonight is my great pleasure to introduce Dr. William Pickens. He's the founder and president of the Montier Family Association, which is a private entity dedicated to preserving, administering, and sharing the family's more than 300-year history in America. He received his Bachelor's of Arts in History and Politics and Political Science, in 1958 from the University of Vermont, where he was the first African-American president of the student body. He served as a second lieutenant in the 5th Air Force in Japan. And when he returned to New York City in 1961, he continued his education at New York University in the Political Science Master's Program. Dr. Pickens then joined the corporate world, and he founded the Bill Pickens Associates, his own international consulting and executive search firm. Dr. Pickens has served as director or trustee in many organizations, including the NAACP, the Paul Robeson Foundation, the Boys and Girls Harbor Incorporated, the National Committee on American Foreign Policy, and the Studio Museum in Harlem, one of my favorite museums in all of the country. In 2009, Dr. Pickens loaned a rare pair of African-American portraits from 1841 to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. They depict his ancestors, Hiram Charles Montier and his wife, Elizabeth Brown Montier, who are descendants of Philadelphia's first mayor, Humphrey Murray. They're still on view there. If you go to the Philadelphia Museum of Art, they're truly wonderful portraits, and I know we're going to hear much more about those and some of this amazing material that's here. In fact, you're sort of a walking museum and archive in of yourself. I also want to welcome quite a few members of Dr. Pickens' family. Thank you so much for coming. We really appreciate it. No, he's just been his son, and you have an uncanny family resemblance. I think everyone must tell you that. So what we plan to do is hear about the story of Dr. Pickens' family. We'll have a quick Q&A session afterwards. And then I'm going to invite Lee Arnold, our director of the Collection and Library, to tell us a little bit about the materials that are both sitting on your chair and then what we have on show for you from our collection downstairs in the reading room. And I hope you stay, because it seems to me we have a lot of food downstairs and you really must be fed before you leave. So thank you very much, Dr. Pickens, for coming, and thank you all for being here. And the microphone is yours.
Good evening, all. The Morays and Montiers are thrilled to be here in Philadelphia, where they arrived on different ships and settled more than 300 years ago. I wish to thank the Historical Society of Pennsylvania for this invitation to share this unique colonial love story. I've had the pleasure to share this saga before Drexel University, Arcadia College, the world-class Philadelphia Museum of Art, Jack and Jill of America and the Sigma Pi Phi fraternity. I salute Board Chair Sarah D. Price, the Board of Counselors, the Society staff, especially the irrepressible Mary Grace Gilmore, your Senior Director of Development, and a hearty thank you to Kim Sajak, Karen Price Ward, Pat Coulter, and Emily Kretschmer, who spells her Emily just as my mother did with I-E. I also want to give a shout out to a brilliant acclaimed writer and reporter named Donald Scott from Glenside, who has delved into the Moray Montier family history big time. And a shout out to a new author of a marvelous story of John Baxter Taylor, a Philadelphia University of Pennsylvania graduate who ran in the 1908 Olympics and was buried in Eden Cemetery, which we visited today. He's the first African-American to win a medal in the Olympics. And Craig Williams is the author, and he'll be joining us shortly. Here he lives up in Conshohocken. So that sets some of the stage for us. In reviewing your literature, I noticed that amongst your stalwart supporters are Biddles, Cadwalladers, Mathers, and Rittenhouses, the very same families extending to the early life of this proud commonwealth. Moreover, I was delighted to see my good friend and collector extraordinaire, Charles L. Bloxham, on your board of counselors. For the Urban Leaguers, just completing your 100th year of service as well, let me share a bit of history. When my late grandpa, Dr. William Pickens Sr., was graduating with highest honors from Yale University in 1904, he left behind his huge study desk for a young Yale Divinity student named Dr. George Edmund Haynes. No one knew at the time that 4 to 5 years later, 1909-1910, these two Yalies would help found and fund the NAACP and the National Urban League. Not too shabby for a couple of brothers from the Ivy League. Can I get an amen? And a shout out to Southwest Airlines and to CEO Greg Kelly for their sponsorship of this event. My family flies with you guys a lot out of MacArthur Airport in Long Island, and our nephew is one of your pets. Your society has served the Commonwealth exceptionally well since its founding in 1824. The archive of facts, figures, and personalities fosters a beehive of activities for scholars, historians, researchers, students, and media. This, my friends, is a quintessential American story and an essential Philadelphia saga. The Morays and Montiers involve a tripartite confluence of cultures, values, ethnicities, and genders. Yes, we have Mother Africa in the land of Guinea, West Africa, Western Europe, in terms of France and England, and Native Americans or First Peoples, the Delawares or Lenapes, right here on the Delaware. It is no mystery that human instincts propel males and females to link up, to reproduce, to protect their progeny, and to train them to survive. When one views my family's tree, it conveys a rainbow of colorations, profiles, and body types. What unites them is a strong bond of love. This behavioral trait extends back more than 350 years. The Morays and Montiers figured out how to build and sustain a multiracial, multi-talented lineage, a role model of sorts for this grand American experiment. Here's how we're going to proceed this splendid evening. We have produced some 30 exhibits for your enjoyment and perusal. They, in toto, form an historic timeline of the Moray Montier family. Procedurally, my beloved son, John Montier Pickens, named for our family founder, John Montier, born in 1740, probably in Fort Washington, he'll hold up or point to each document seen on the easels about, and I will reference that document or photograph in sequence during my remarks. This should take 40 minutes or so, to be followed by a Q&A period of 15 minutes or so. Upon completion, feel free to come up and take a good look at these items. As you may can attest, I am a well-documented U.S. citizen. Birthers beware. Let me now recognize my lovely wife, Pat, and my darling daughter, Pam, who just came up from Florida to be able to stand up so they can see you guys. Just imagine if the heroic Harriet Tubman had access to iPods, Blackberries, and Twitter accounts in the Underground Railroad. What I call early social networking. Not Facebook, but Gracebook. Why they would have ended slavery in one fell swoop. In the Middle Passage, those slaves who were either thrown overboard or who jumped comprised the community of free blacks, albeit on the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, for they had a sense that if they arrived in the New World, they would have been less free than their experience in old Africa. Think about that. Slaves came here, they would have been less free. Everybody else would have been free, except the natives and the Africans. So, when records of marriages, baptismals, property records, last wills and testaments, photographs and the like are preserved and passed along generationally, any family has the ability to trace its history and genealogy. However, enslaved persons were not recognized for their humanity, only for their commodity. Few records, save sales slips, were deemed worthy of preservation. As a matter of fact, the genealogy of racehorses was deemed a crucial record. The genealogy of humans, not so. All humankind is connected. And that's why our story tonight will, I think, enliven you and enrich you. While it won't pay the rent, secure a job, or fill the belly, it surely can warm the heart. Let us begin. Our story begins in 1574 in France. The Morays were French Huguenots. Protestants were beset upon by the Catholics in that 16th century. Henry IV, Henri IV, King of France, lived as a Protestant, but he was baptized a Catholic. That caused some real problems in the monarchy. But the Moray family, right there, is their crest. Right there is their crest. The Montier family does not have a crest, although we use the toothpaste. And those Morays all came to Philadelphia. They left Europe, they even left Holland and Germany, where they had repaired when they got chased out of France. But Henry IV, Henri IV, issued the Edict of Nantes in 1598 to save the Protestants, because he believed in that faith. He had a son, Louis XIII, who tried to keep things going. Then he came to Louis XIV, in 1685, when he revoked the Edict of Nantes and said everyone should be Catholic. Well, the Morays had fled. Lots of Protestants had fled Europe. When they got to Philadelphia, our founder, Humphrey Moray, first came to Oyster Bay, New York, where he was a merchant, a landowner, and an import-export guy. We found his wife, Annie Moray, English, in Google Books, Volume 1, in 1677. So they lived in Oyster Bay. But he got wind of what William Penn was up to. And when Penn made this purchase of land he never owned, it was given to him by Charles II in payment of a debt to his father, who was the admiral who conquered Jamaica, the king. Charles II, who never visited this area, gave it all to him. Penn had all this land, thousands of square miles. Humphrey Moray came down, and in 1683, remember this was 1682 when Penn started, he purchased 250 acres, which is this next folder right here. He's the guy on the extreme right. That's his 251st purchase. Then he added to it, he wound up about 1,000 acres. Humphrey Morey was there, and he was the sixth wealthiest man, they said, in the Commonwealth at that point. So, Henry Morey decided, with his two sons, to settle here with Anne. Anne finally decided that this was too rough and tumble. She was a society lady from England, so she split and went back with money sometime around 1715, 1714. In the meantime, Humphrey Morey lost one son, John, who died in 1698, but Richard, his surviving son, is the one I'm interested in, and I hope you'll be interested. Richard Morey inherited much of his father's largesse. This, my son is holding, is what Philadelphia looked like on his grid system that Benjamin Franklin helped create. And Home, the carpet cartographer mapmaker, laid out for us. So Morey is now ensconced in on Front Street in Philadelphia and on his splendid 250-acre spread, and now what they call Glenside, where Arcadia College is, and the Limekiln Pipeline's right up that gut. Now, Humphrey Morey becomes a powerful person in colonial America, and he was among the first 75,000 colonists to a country today that has 310 million people. So he was early in America and laid down his stake. Reporters picked this up, named the Biddles, Clement and Alexander Biddle. Two historians figured out that he indeed was the first mayor appointed by William Penn. Up to that point, they thought that a guy named Ed Chipman was the first mayor. He didn't become mayor until 1701 when Humphrey Morey gave up his job and moved back to what is now Glenside, Pennsylvania. So, Humphrey has a son, Richard. He also has some slaves who came from Guinea. Where they lived, they called it Guinea Town. The slaves, some 20 of them, all lived together and married each other. You know, you marry what's available. And they were all first cousins. They were married. So that's how the family started. The Morey family were Quakers, and Humphrey Morey decided he detested slavery. He found it useful for a while, but he really detested it. And in Germantown, when the Quakers issued their proclamation in 1688 saying slavery no more, he took heed, and in his will, he freed his slaves. Well, one of them was my great-great-great-great-grandmother, Cremona Morey. She was a baby in slavery, and she was freed when she was about 6 years old. Now, Anne is going back to England. Humphrey Morey is looking around. He's okay. But Richard, his son, is now beginning to feel his oats. He's prosperous. He's handsome. Dad's died. He inherits most of Dad's largesse. And he has as a house servant this young African woman. She's dutiful, practical, works hard, and is getting lovelier and lovelier as the years go on. His wife's gone, and she's around, and about 1732, they start a committed romance. It was so committed, they had five children, two boys and three girls, between 1735 and 1744. This family all loved one another, all worked hard together, and took care of one another. They were landholders, landowners, they had money, they had position, but you remember that even as free blacks weren't as free as free whites. There were many constrictions and restrictions on their freedom. As a matter of fact, in 1703 in Philadelphia, if three black men were seen on a corner, they were arrested. It was a city ordinance that said that they were meddlesome and troublesome. Well, that probably holds true today. So much has changed. But in any event, things settled in. The Moray children grew up. Richard Moray now had this bride, sort of, five children. He was getting old. So in 1745, he said, I have to protect my family. Meanwhile, he had taken on another wife named Sarah, another English woman. So he had parallel families. Sounds like Schwarzenegger. So here we are in colonial America. I guess you've got a lot of history. He managed both families quite well. I hear every now and then from the other family. A lot of them live in Florida. I am too. So, Richard took care of his family. In 1745, he issued an indenture that said Cremona Moray would inherit 198 acres of land in his last will. That made her the richest sister in Philadelphia. I'm telling you, 198 acres of land. But of course, women, white or black, or Native American, could not really run and own things. Vote and nothing more rights. So he put a Quaker friend, Isaac Knight, next door neighbor, who knew about these children, knew about their love affair, and he said, you protect them. You're rich, you're a Quaker, you know the family, you know our relationship, you take care of them. And he did. Cremona, now the widow Cremona, the one who was born in 1710, remarries. She remarries. Richard dies in 1753. She remarries in about 1758 to a gentleman named Joe Fry. He was really Joe Free. He'd been freed. He was a slave and freed. In those days, if you fry free, you could be fried, I guess. He'd rather be free than fried. In any event, he took charge of this family, and they had a son. Cremona, who was married to Richard, now has a son, Joe. The five children of Richard got very angry. They said, wait a minute. Under the law, an estate in its entirety goes to the husband. And he was not the daddy of these children. So they went to a meeting house in Abington and resolved it. They said, Joe, you can live in this house till you die. And your son, at some point, will sell his interest back to the five Moray children. So you have Robert Louis Moray, the eldest son, Caesar Moray, who moved to Jersey. You had Elizabeth Moray, beautiful Elizabeth. You know about her, don't rejoice. And then there was Rachel Moray and Cremona. That last Cremona is my Cremona. I descend from her, from all my children. So, you had a couple of marriages, you had Philadelphia growing. Penn was even in jail in England because he didn't pay his bills, so he was in debtor's prison. And the Morays tried to keep Philadelphia rolling along with their cavalrys and everything. They kept this operation going while Penn suffered. This takes us to the next wonderful exhibit, which is Colonial Mayors of Philadelphia. Shippen, the second mayor, turned out to be a cousin of Humphrey Moray, the first mayor. And he was the executor of the Moray estate. And the Shippen family, you see them all through Philadelphia history. So I'm not sure we're related to the Shippens, but it's possible to the Morays. We'll explore that in the next one. Now, the Moray children were, I say, fairly prosperous. They were free, they had homes, they had jobs, and they loved one another and took care of one another. So, John Montier, this young man, they think maybe from the Fort Washington area as well, comes to Guineatown and meets up with Cremona number two, baby Cremona. This is about 1763, just before the Stamp Act. They fall in love, they get married the year after the Stamp Act, and the Intolerable Acts. They lived in this barn. Exhibit 6 is the family barn that was built in 1766. They built that until they had a house, which would be 5 years later. And they lived there. That is now a private home. It's been remodeled. That's the way it looked when my family had it. Way back then, 1766, 10 years before the Declaration of Independence. So, 5 years after that, John Montier, who now had two children, Joseph and Solomon, I'm from Solomon, built this home, which you see here. This home is 312 Limekiln Pike. It's probably the oldest African-American built home in the Commonwealth. This was built in 1770, the same year Crispus Attucks was shot in Boston for protesting the British command of America. So, this house is still up, and a family lives in it to this day. We have family reunions there every 10 years. Now, let's move on. The family prospers, they've settled their account with all of the powers that be, the laws. Everybody has a home. We have 198 acres. Everybody has 12, 15 acres of land. We bought out little Joseph, and the family is now ready to take a role into the next century. So, but Robert Lewis, the senior, Robert Lewis Murray, the senior man, said, you know, black folk, when they die, are put in potter's fields, typically. That ain't going to happen to us. I'm going to set aside some land on Limekiln Pike and make it a permanent family burial ground. This indenture, 1798, was written on deerskin with a musket hole still in. It was attested to by the judges. Witnessed by a lot of famous guys like Fitzwater and Tyson. They have a lot of speech named after Fitzwater and Tyson. They're all signed on this document. This is an original document. And we're very proud of that. I call it Magna Carta. This is the burial ground that was supposed to sustain the family all into the future. That didn't happen, and I'll share that with you in a moment. But that's 1798, and that wonderful old English document is very precious to my family. It'll probably wind up in some society somewhere in America someday. We're holding on to it for now. Now, the Montier family went into some businesses. Shoemaking, wagoning, coopering, making barrels. By the time the 19th century rolls around, America is beginning to grow, the War of 1812 hasn't happened yet, and Hiram Montier, this handsome gentleman here, born in 1818, meets this charming femme fatale from the Northern Liberties, Elizabeth Brown, takes a liking to her. He's a fairly prosperous shoemaker at 41 Chestnut, which is right on the Delaware. It's now a park. But he had his business at 41, and they got together and got married. His photography was in its infant stages, if at all, and you had daguerreotypes from France. That was all they had. He had a white artist named Franklin Street commissioned to sit down and paint these wedding portraits. Now, these portraits kicked around my family for decades. They finally devolved to me. We had them repaired for posterity. And they're at the museum to this day. But there they are, wedding portraits. They may be the only portraits of that kind in America, in the entire history of our country. Wedding portraits of a young African American couple 1841. If you haven't seen them yet, feel free to go up to the museum. They're on display. For the last 2.5 years, my wife and I gave them to the museum in honor of Barack and Michelle Obama. So they're on display. You can check them out. But the family continued to grow and make babies, the Montier family. The wings started spreading. And one wing in particular is of interest. Just briefly, Elizabeth Lorray, the eldest daughter of Cremona and Richard, produced one of America's most interesting men, Paul Robeson. Paul Robeson is in the family on another wing, the Elizabeth Lorray wing. And you'll notice quickly that this is my grandmother, and this is Paul Robeson's mother. They look like bookends. Remember, they all marry each other, cousins and so forth. So they look very much alike. But Paul Robeson came from this family on the Elizabeth Lorray wing. Just before that are some documents from the Civil War and marriage certificates. We had an indentured servant in our family, and he was released after 7 years learning how to make shoes. So he prospered. We have here the wedding certificate of 1841 of their marriage, a letter from the Civil War, and other marriage certificates. So the documents we preserved, thank goodness, when they all came to rest in my feet when I was a young man. So the family continued to grow. America continued to grow. 1841, there were 17 million Americans. But then the Civil War hits, and they go to war. Well, they went to war, and these guys, all Montiers and cousins, all fought, the 12 of them, all fought in the Civil War on the Union side, thank God. They knew where their bread was buttered. Now, yeah. 1836, just after War 1812. We saw a family Bible. And this is the 1836 version. We listed the names of weddings and baptisms and so forth, and you're free to take a look at that upon conclusion. Things pick up. America grows and changes. Women are looking for education. Some didn't get educated. Our family thought women should be educated. So, my grandmother, God bless her, enrolled at Drexel Institute in the year after they opened. This is her report card, 1894. English, she got good. Algebra, fair. Geometry, good. History, good. Chemistry, excellent. Functionality, good. She went to Drexel, which became Drexel University. And the university was started by Anthony Drexel for African Americans, for women, and for Native Americans. And she went. Now, she's a college-educated woman. She's nice-looking, well-prepared. She meets this guy, Grandpa Brown. He's from Harrisburg. They got married, and that was written up in this news article in 1897. So the Montiers are moving right along through American culture, moving right up the scale. Their wedding was lovely, and all Montiers, you see their names and tenants. Not bad. That's 200 years have gone by now, and we're still getting married, thank goodness. Way back when, all this started. St. Thomas's Church, 1792, way back. Religious family? Yes. Very religious, very concerned? Yes. And the Montiers put money into the treasury to help start St. Thomas's Church. That was very interesting. That church, which I think has moved 5 times, we came to see the 3 of our family weddings, 1841, 1872, and this last one, 1897. The church is wonderful. They have maintained wonderful records. And the Montier family has been generically close to this church ever since. And I must tell you, today I had an emotional moment. I went out to Eden Cemetery and I finally found the birthplace of this man right here. I've been looking for it for 21 years. And my son located it with some help. And we went out there today and put some flowers on his grave. Hiram Montier is in Eden. Eden Cemetery has wonderful guests. Harry Anderson's there. William Still. Cato. Julian Abel. It's amazing. And of course, Abner Jones was there until it was moved to the church. So, Hiram Montier keeps a pretty good company in the Eden Cemetery. And we're proud of that. I was really struck by that fact today. I did not know where they were. So now we can pay our respects going forward. But when you do genealogical work, one has to be dogged and determined. You want to stay with it. You have a lot of records. If you don't have records, you can get assistance from the genealogists at various historical societies like this great one right here. But the family continued to grow. We didn't stop with this wedding in 1897. We went on, the Montiers, who became school teachers, wagoners, shoemakers, all kinds of jobs in Philadelphia and in New Jersey, contributed to American society, to the life we can all enjoy today. The Murray family, we don't know as much about the Murrays as we know about the Montiers, which I find very ironic because the English folks kept massive records. There may be something more about them here in this facility, and that would merit some further research on all of our parts. But the Montier family was meticulous in keeping its records and its history in shape, which is why we're able to produce these documents and more about this wonderful family. They went on and produced another family, my mother's family. And you'll see them right here, right in front of the lectern. My mother was a beautiful model, born here in Catherine Street, South Catherine Street, and that's her sister, Ida. My mother's sister was Marian Anderson's best friend. They grew up together, played dolls together, and spent a lifetime enjoying one another's company. My mother, this is my uncle down here, Richard Montier, who lives in Chateau Montier in Los Angeles. He took the family name West. He wouldn't be able to get a close up of all of them. Now, my mother and my dad, right here, got married in 1930. They were quite a striking couple then, and they were introduced by Langston Hughes, who was my father's roommate in college at Lincoln University, which is just down the pike, about 40 miles from Philadelphia. My mother, God bless her, was a Girl Reserve secretary here in Philadelphia. All the young girls loved her, white and black alike. When Langston got to Lincoln University and met my father, his roommate, my mother had written him to come and speak, read some poems to the girls at the Y. And he wrote her back. I have that letter saying, "I'm not famous. What do you want to hear my poetry for?" She persisted, and he went and checked her out. Came back and told his roommate, "Wow, I was a stunner in Philadelphia." But my dad was from Harlem. He went and checked her out. A few years later, they were married. And Langston became, as his roommate, his old lady, as they said, at Lincoln, a lifetime friend of both of them. But he was instrumental in them getting hooked up back in the 20s. Another famous American named Elaine Locke, Dr. Elaine Locke, the first black Rhodes Scholar, Harvard, 1907, by Ben Capital. He lived around the corner from my mother in good old Philadelphia. And here in Exhibit 22, you have several references to not only Paul Rhodes, but to my mother and Elaine Locke, who shared a lively correspondence for about 30 years. And there are a couple of cards there with 2 cent stamps on them. That sounds familiar, 2 cent stamps from those years gone by. But the Montier family continued here in Philadelphia to prosper, to grow, to change with America. And they had a head start because they were free. They weren't saddled with all the problems that enslavement brought to African people. So they were able to spread their wings a bit. They were able to get educated. They were able to get married. And they made children, and they grew the children, and they nurtured the children, and they went on to do other things in life. But the fact that they were free in this society gave them a big leg up on the progress that we could make as a unit, as a family unit. This was not something that was allowed generally in America. So when you look at how free blacks operated against how enslaved took charge, the differences are vast. And the Montier family proves that the efficacy of freedom is solid. It's very solid. And enslavement is ruinous and detrimental and evil. But America went through all that. But we went from George Washington to Barack Obama, and from Humphrey Murray to Mike Nutter. So that's more than a modicum of progress in America. And it's shocking to some people. I think I was a bit shocked on Election Day a few years ago myself. But America has tried to overcome its debilitating weaknesses, like enslaving people. We're still working at it, folks. We haven't solved all this yet. We're moving forward. We need to establish our records. We need to share those records. We need to encourage people to go out and seek where they're from. Where are your forebears? Your descendants. I think it's important to know where you come from, to the extent to which you can do that. It enlivens your step. You get a little shoulder back, because you know a little more about what went on in the womb, who was daddy, who was granddaddy. I think it's important to know that stuff. Many of us can't go back past grandparents because of poor record keeping or no record keeping. But many of us who did have records in this place may contain a lot more than even I know about my own family, which means that I'll be coming back here very often. They just made me an honorary member for the next year. So I'm going to take advantage of that, coming by Amtrak, mule, somewhere I'm getting down here to take care of this place. But you see my family, when the bicentennial hit in 1976, they made a poster in Glenside featuring some of the businesses and homesteads. And we were proud to be added to that. You'll see the Montier house on there. The house is probably the oldest African-American residence in the Commonwealth. And I can't invite you to go see it inside because there's a family there. But you can certainly drive by and take a good look. In looking at all of this, I wrote Mike Nutter, your mayor, and I said, you know, Mike, there's an anniversary coming up of an African-American woman born here in Philadelphia in 1710. What do you think about a proclamation? He said, yes, sir. And issued a proclamation on October 27th of last year to praise the birth and growth of this woman who made so many babies who contributed to American life, to make it better, not bitter. And he not only issued a proclamation, but Tom Shelton issued a proclamation where our family lived, and Norristown issued a proclamation. So we had a trifecta. for Cremona. Miles Davis could do a riff on that, a trifecta for Cremona. And we're proud of that because we wanted to establish when she arrived, what she did, how she contributed to this country. I think it's important for all of us to share as best we can our own family histories with one another, children who grow up and say, geez, I didn't know I had a grandfather. You see an Ancestry.com on TV, and I said, I didn't know my grandfather was a businessman. He started out as a slave. I think it's useful to know. It doesn't bring firecrackers, explosions of joy, but I think it's fundamentally an important part of our history. And as my grandfather said, we still know more about horses. The genealogy of a horse is carefully maintained. I think it'd be medical attention, better health care. I think we have good health care too. That's another argument. Horses get plenty of it. So, this in total is my family. I'm really proud of this document because this is the first census taken in the United States in 1791. Benjamin Franklin was put in charge by all the founding fathers. And two of our family names, three of our family names are in this, two on this page and one on the page behind. This is John Montier and Robert Lewis Murray, and Cyrus Bustle is on the other sheet. So this is the very first census taken, three black men taking care of their families. Robert had 13 under his wing, John Montier 6. So they all lived happily ever after in Guineatown. But the first census proudly records the arrival and vocation of these gentlemen. There's another column that says enslaved. Neither of these gentlemen is on that list. But all these records are here. I see there are other things that kind of tested their lives and their spirits. I'm proud to be a member of this family, and I think that as we go forward, a guy like Paul Robeson, seen here with my cousin, his cousin, Daniel Jackson Sanders, who's a Montier, his mother's Marian Anderson's buddy, and they're having a little chat with coffee and coke. And then there's a picture here of Paul Robeson Jr., yours truly, as we celebrated his father's 100th birthday in New York at an event. Paul's on the back, Paul Jr. right here. He's 83 years old now, lives in New York, and doesn't sing. Finally, they took a picture of me just to show that I'm still around. That's our story, and from the genealogist's point of view, as you look at all of these records in front of you, how they're doing great, 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 it's a meticulous, organized process. And if you take this home with you and begin to look at old family pictures, family letters, you can begin to fill in the blanks here. And everyone here can begin to trace very methodically in an organized way their family histories. It's going to be tough. It takes some slogging. You can come here, go to other facilities. New York Public Library's got a lot of stuff too. But I think it's useful. It's fun. You'll probably run out of room in your house. I mean, George Carlin, the late comedian, said that he had so much stuff in his house, he had to get another house just to put stuff in. My wife says the same thing about me. But we have stuff. When I had my son, my daughter, and my other son, and my granddaughter, who will get all this stuff someday, and I hope they're able to share it with their friends, as I was given the pleasure and privilege of sharing with you tonight. I'm going to conclude my remarks and just open up questions after I take a sip of water, because it's a Philadelphia martini. And just really wrap it up and Claudia are coming tonight. Came down from New York with all this stuff in the car, and tomorrow we're going back. We'll get here in the morning and load it up again, take it home to where we live in Sag Harbor, New York, way out near Monzon Point. And that's where all these documents are. And some of my Boulay friends and brothers are here, and I'm so glad to see them. They know where I live, and when you guys come out, you can see these close up too. I would like to just say thanks and take a swig, and then we'll open up the Q&A before we go down and get a light event. Okay? Let me take a swig. My son just said that Craig Williams, the author of The Olympiad, this wonderful book I mentioned at the outset, is here. Craig, stand up so the folks can see you. He's the author of this wonderful book, The Olympiad, about John Baxter Taylor, the first African-American medalist in the Olympics in 1908 at the University of Pennsylvania. So I commend that to your attention. Craig is here, and I'm sure he'll be able to repass, share some insights about that.
Well, Dr. Pickens, let me first of all thank you very much for documenting the history of your family and sharing that with all of us here. And if you haven't written any of this in the book, I encourage you to do so. But I have two questions, two brief questions. First of all, is this story included in the African American history courses that are now required in the Philadelphia public schools?
Well, it's beginning to happen because of these portraits. The Philadelphia school children, public school children, are all coming to see these portraits, and they have to bring a notepad and write about their reaction to these portraits. And I'm hoping that that little bit will spark further interest in the African-American history here in Philadelphia. But Mark Mitchell, over at the museum, has an organized program. They even have a cartoon and a coloring book for the children to go ahead and make their interpretations and impressions of these two portraits, which I commend to everyone.
Well, thank you. The other question has to do with the religious affiliation of the Montier family. There were two denominations, African-American denominations, founded in Philadelphia.
Right.
One, of course, was the African Methodist Episcopal, Richard Allen.
Right.
The other was the church established by Absalom Jones,
that's
the one that you referred to.
That's
now, well, I have a question, and that is, why did your family affiliate with the American Anglicans rather than Richard Allen's AME denomination?
Well, they made a family judgment. Probably Robert Lewis, the elder, was probably friendly with Absalom Jones. And I'm sure they knew one another quite well. They were all in the Free Africa Society. He probably felt more comfortable with Absalom Jones' liturgy and view of where they should take the African Episcopal Church. It's a guess on my part, but I think it's a good guess of where they stood. But they did not begrudge Richard Allen. They admired Richard Allen. There was no animosity between those guys. But it was a judgment call, and when you have two, you can make a call. We were lucky to have two. Those other folks have a lot of twos.
That's right.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Brandon. Yes.
Did members of your family also stay Quaker? I mean, on the Bustle side.
Well, on the Bustle side, they stayed Quaker a long time, longer than the Montiers. But stand up, Joyce, and introduce yourself. She's my cousin. We just met, but she's from a wing of the Bustle family, and I'm hoping that events like this will bring out more of my relatives.
My name is Joyce Mosley, and my great grandmother. His grandfather was Cyrus Bustle Miller, so I've been tracing my family back through Cyrus Bustle and Elizabeth Norrie. So we're cousins back that far, but and through the Cyrus Bustle is the Warrior family is Paul Robeson, and there's also David Bustle, who ran an Underground Railroad station, and also there is Cyrus Bustle Jr., who was also part of that underground. And there's a lot of documentation. Cyrus Bustle actually was a baker in Philadelphia. And as the family story goes, and this is actually documented in a book that was written about 100 years ago, Cyrus Bustle actually took bread to George Washington when they were camped out of Valley Forge. And there's a statue out in Valley Forge right now about the African-American patriots, and Cyrus Bustle was mentioned on that.
Thank you. Fine. Thank you, Joyce. I just want to point out, this is my late brother. He's a direct descendant of this guy, too. They kind of look alike, don't they? Richard, going to your pickings. Okay, any more questions? Yes. Give the mic.
I was fascinated about the Cheltenham African American experience. I'm from Cheltenham, and I thought that it all started around the Lamont section. So how did one house, how did they occupy the one house on Limekiln Pike, which you know, I'm going to ride by and take a look, since you discovered this?
Well, they were left the land in 1745. Lamont is a Civil War kind of story. This is a pre-revolutionary story. And the family cherished that land. Of course, the house that remains today is on 1 acre, and this old barn is on 1 acre. Those are the surviving acres. The rest of it is now residence and all kinds of homes and schools and everything. But our family owned all that land for many, many years, for about 60 years. And with taxes and estates and assaults and road building and you name it, we lost much of the land. But these last 2 acres survive, and you're certainly free to drive by and take a look. There are two handsome homes there. But the Lamont story is 100 years later.
My question deals with the first African. I understand it's 1688.
Eight.
Yes, yeah. those first Africans of 150 came off the ship Elizabeth. So
1684.
84, excuse me. So are Montier a part of that?
My folks arrived in 1693.
Okay.
9 years later. 9 years later.
Okay.
11. Okay.
I have a question about young people who are seeking information about their genealogy. Many of the people that I grew up with don't know their fathers, and that is oftentimes one of the blockades for moving forward into finding this information.
Sure.
Do you have any suggestions or ideas about how to move forward through that information with minimal information?
Well, that's a huge sociological issue. If you don't know your daddy, it really gets complicated. I don't want to be facetious about this, but you have to have some early linkage that establishes a man and a woman in a marriage that has some certificates of birth or death as a minimum. I think that's a very challenging assignment. I commend you for trying to pursue it. I don't have any nuggets of wisdom, except really, look, my wife may have a nugget of wisdom. Darling?
As you probably have heard.
Yes, here comes a mic.
No, I don't need a mic.
Oh, you take a mic.
I have had to sit through many genealogists who are just thrilled because he has his records from 1790 in the first census, and they all get excited. And they want to help him. So they say, what about you? Were you here? No. But I did discover a family name. If you can find geography and a family name and go to a genealogist who's not busy in a city like Arkansas where it's free, and they will sit down with you and ask you the kind of questions that you might not bring to mind. And those kinds of questions could be, Have you ever had any family stories about things? And sometimes the words, the spellings are different. They will help you and tell you what was going on around the time. And slavery was interesting. Craig's family, Williams, his mother, went back and found out by just doing the same kind of thing. You just go, you ask somebody, you're interested, you take your time, and sometimes it's 10 cents a copy in Seattle, or it's free in some place, because Clinton is very big on genealogy. Any of those places that you go to, they don't even charge you for the copies. They happen to have somebody who's interested in what they're doing. I believe it's the Mormon Church has all of the shipping records. I think the Library of Congress has a lot of the landowning property changes, wills, etc. So if you are interested and you can get the time, in other words, your birthday, and try to estimate was your father 16, 20, 25, you can take a 10-year period. Sometimes you can find a family name of an uncle or a great uncle that's still living, or you heard the story about the crazy uncle or the wonderful uncle, and you say, I'll look up that name, because one of the other interesting findings was, in his family and my family, there are Elizabeths across the board. There are Emmas across the board. There are Roses across the board. There are certain names that were very common in those days. So if you are willing to go from that direction, you have at least the currents. And different people will give you clues. And I believe up there, they're all waiting for you to knock on the door and ask a question. Because today, we were in the cemetery, which for 21 years, we have been looking for the remains of those distinguished people. And there they were, because two men from this area became interested in the story and said, we know where the Montiers are buried. And the cemetery is the second burial place. The first burial place was where the indenture is. The second, they moved the road, they moved them to Lebanon. Then they moved Lebanon when they were moving, what they call it, urban removal. And they moved them out past Darby to some beautiful, lovely landscape place that is full of African American history. So even walking around the cemetery, you might find something that would bring to mind. So you just have to be very receptive, find people who are receptive, and just write the kernels down.
Now you see here George Washington, his wife, of course, inherited a couple of hundred slaves, and they helped build Mount Vernon. And here, our story is very un-Jeffersonian, because Jefferson had a family, but he wouldn't admit it. Unlike Mr. Moray, who said, okay, these are my kids, take care of them. So here's Thomas, and here's, but their family fathers. Today we have fathers who are too far away. We need to bring the names in. I hope you can find that. Yes.
Excuse me, maybe we just at this point very quickly mention materials that we left on your chairs and what they mean.
Yes.
Because what many people are not aware of, the Historical Society of Pennsylvania has the third largest collection of family history in the United States. And in fact, if you would indulge me for a bit, Lee Arnold, who's also a registered genealogist, can actually walk you through some of the steps for those of you who are interested. We run many workshops, actually, particularly on how to do your genealogy. We know there are specific issues related to those people who have descended from enslaved Africans. And if we don't have the answers, we have a lot of databases here, such as you can just come in and use all of the records from Ancestry.com and GenBank and others. So we can certainly take a few more questions, but I thought maybe we could hand over to Lee for a minute just to talk about what we have. Because there's a lot of material right here, and it's all on this site. So maybe Lee can step up, and then we can go to some questions at the back, and we have some materials also. Perhaps you could also talk about what we have downstairs. So you might want to use that.
Here's the mic.
I feel so insignificant here after this wonderful talk, so I apologize you have to listen to me right now. But anyway, as we said, on your chairs are some family history group sheets. These are just some things that really will help you. You just sit down and just start penciling in what you know. As his wife said, you know, you know, think of the stories, and you can really work your way back then. And also, too, if you don't know a lot of males in the line, go through the females. There's nothing magical about tracing your line simply by male, 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 male. Why not go female, female, female? You can do it. You can do it. So the first two are just family group sheet. The second one is just a wonderful tool. You've always heard people, well, sometimes talking, even jokingly, oh, it's my third cousin five times removed. You're like, what does that mean? You can go to this chart, you can find out where you are or where the other relative is, and you kind of put your fingers together, and that tells you what kind of cousin and how many removes that is. So that's a really good thing. I always thought I was a first cousin, a cousin of someone that turned out as a first cousin once removed, too new. But anyway, so that's a really good thing to do. I want to just talk to you a little bit about what we have downstairs. So after the question and answer time, when you do go downstairs, you'll kind of know what kind of show and tell that we have. And I tell you, this is so great. The doctor was mentioning all kinds of things that relate to what I have to show you downstairs. I have three rows of tables in the reading room. The very first table has the diary of William Still, who was a conductor of the Underground Railroad. You mentioned Still is in the same cemetery here. I have it open to a day that Harriet Tubman brought a group of enslaved Africans to freedom. And so that's just a really wonderful, very moving page of the Still diary. I also have a copy of the Emancipation Proclamation with Abraham Lincoln's original signature, the Secretary of State Seward's signature, and Lincoln's Secretary Nicolay's signature. They made 44 of these to raise money for the Great Sanitary Fair, which was to raise money for the sick and wounded Civil War soldiers. And we have this document, all of the original signatures. The third thing I have is I have a family chart of Humphrey Murray and his wife Anne downstairs. That was from our collection. And so that you can see. And then one thing that really struck me as I was listening to this, that the history of this family really is the history of this city and this area, and of course the history of this country. And the Historical Society is the home of the the American Negro Historical Society. We have all their papers here, and we have a wonderful set of portraits that rarely get shown, but I thought I would just show them tonight. So we have 15 portraits from the American Negro Historical Society collection laid out, and that's in our middle table. And finally, in our last table, I have a bunch of resources, how-to books on how to do your African-American genealogy and how to research African-Americans in Pennsylvania. So feel free to take a look at those books, thumb through them, get some ideas, jot down names and authors if you want to pick up that book yourself. So those are things. Let me just mention one more thing before, and I'll happily give back the microphone, is Kim was talking about how to do genealogy. We have genealogy workshops coming up this October here at the Historical Society. Go to our website at hsp.org, and you can look at that schedule once we, hopefully it's up soon, the schedule. It'll be up soon. But yeah, October is Family History Month, and those are our how-to genealogy workshops. Just come on in, we'll try to get you started. And then we do have a raffle this evening, so that if you purchase or renew your membership here at HSP, so either a new membership or renewed membership, we will put your name in a raffle, and at 7:45 tonight, we will draw it, and you will win two free tickets on Southwest Airlines. And you can use it to go to a family history library, like in Salt Lake City, or the Newberry Library in Chicago, or the one in Boston, or anywhere else that you know that has would help you with your family research, and that Southwest Airlines goes, of course. But anyway, so two free airline tickets are one if you take out a new membership or renew your membership with the Historical Society by 7:45. So, and I'll be downstairs with the items and be happy to talk to anyone about your genealogy. And I would love to have all this. So someday, basically, just
two final points. Here is a seven generations of Montier women from 1841 to 1994, when my granddaughter, now 17, was born. And you can take a look at this. Seven generations of our women who have kept our family going strong. Mina Karkoff from the Eden Cemetery is here. Would you stand up so they can all see you? There she is. And of course, having this event between Father's Day and the summer solstice was much better than having it during Black History Month. Black History Month is the shortest, coldest, and darkest month. This is the lightest, nice, brightest, warmest time to do this. So thanks for coming, folks. See you downstairs. We'll take more questions. I'll be downstairs. And I think it's time to sort of break it, get on down. You get first dibs, right? All right. I'll see you downstairs.